the myth and the reality behind Thanksgiving.
The Thanksgiving myth is fundamentally a story about bloodless colonialism. It's a story about indigenous people conceding to the colonization of their country. It's about white people being able to feel guiltless about their invasion of Indian country.
That's historian David Silverman. We talk with him about his book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Then we continue our Thanksgiving week tradition of hearing Native American storyteller and ethnohistorian Marge Bruschak talk about Thanksgiving from the Native point of view. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Thanksgiving is one of America's best-loved holidays. What's not to like about feasting with friends and family? But we would do well to remember that there is a darker side to the holiday, one that moves some modern Native people to hold a day of mourning on Thanksgiving. That's because they know well that the holiday celebrates a myth of colonialism and appropriation of the lands they have inhabited for at least 12,000 years. In 1621, an uneasy alliance existed between the Native Wampanoag tribe and the recently arrived English settlers at Plymouth Colony. The first Thanksgiving was a harvest meal the two groups shared, almost by accident, as we'll hear. David Silverman's new book, This Land is Their Land, is a new look at the Plymouth Colony's founding events, told for the first time with the Wampanoag people at the heart of the story. The book shows that it's time to rethink how we, as a pluralistic nation, tell the history of this holiday. David Silverman is professor of history at George Washington University. Well, David Silverman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
I loved this book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Just to start out, I wonder if you could read the first paragraph of the introduction.
I'd be happy to. And this introduction is titled Mourning in America. Serious critical history tends to be hard on the living. It challenges us to see distortions embedded in the historical national origin myths we have been taught since childhood. It takes enemies, demonized by previous generations, and treats them as worthy of understanding in their particular contexts. Ideological absolutes, civility and savagery, liberty and tyranny, and especially us and them, begin to blur. People from our own society who are not supposed to matter and whose historical experiences show how the injustices of the past have shaped the injustices of the present move from the shadows into the light. Because critical history challenges assumptions and authority, it often leaves us feeling uncomfortable. Yet it also has the capacity to help us become more humble and humane.
Yeah, and we should tell our listeners that mourning in America is spelled M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. First, talk about Thanksgiving as the myth that we have come to know it as, and then tell us how this myth and this holiday developed in its present form.
Sure. I think if you ask most thoughtful adults whether the Thanksgiving myth is good history, they'll be a little bit embarrassed and then concede, probably not. But I think they would struggle to articulate precisely why it's such bad history. The Thanksgiving myth is fundamentally a story about bloodless colonialism. It's a story about indigenous people conceding to the colonization of their country. It's about white people being able to feel guiltless about their invasion of Indian country. What we have in this Thanksgiving myth is friendly Indians, and they're very rarely identified by tribe, making friends with the pilgrims in order to launch the United States as a liberty-loving Christian nation, as a gift to the world. After the dessert is served, the Indians disappear. There's no discussion of what happens to them next. The idea is that they bought in to the nation-building project that the pilgrims supposedly inaugurated. But of course, it's terrible history. You know, the fact of the matter is, as I discuss in this book, that the Wampanoag Indians, who are the native people of this myth, were not simply innately friendly. They reached out to the English for strategic political reasons. And the supposed friendship that they enjoyed with the English was rife with tension and ultimately degenerated into a terrible, bloody war called King Philip's War in 1675-76. And they didn't disappear after that war. The Wampanoags are still very much around today, and they have a very different take on the Thanksgiving holiday than the Thanksgiving myth. As for the origins of that myth, I think most of your listeners will be surprised to learn that the story of pilgrims and Indians was not attached to the Thanksgiving holiday throughout the colonial period. In fact, that association began not in the 1600s, not in the 1700s, it began in the 1800s. And it did so for a number of cultural and political reasons. The myth arose in the mid-19th century at a time when white Protestants in the United States were generally alarmed at the influx of Catholic and later Jewish and Eastern Orthodox Christians from Southern and Eastern Europe. And so the old stock was concerned that their authority was waning. They were concerned that these newcomers didn't understand American democratic values and the values of Protestant Christianity. And the myth was a way of saying that the old stock's forefathers were the progenitors of all basic American values. It was a way of saying, get on board and defer to our authority. This myth also arose at a time when the United States was completing its subjugation of native peoples in the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountain West. It would have been impossible for this myth to gain traction at a time when the United States was engaged in terrible wars against implacable native foes in those regions. But once the subjugation was over, white Americans felt far more comfortable including native people in a national origin myth. And then a final factor has to do with the sanitizing of colonial history. At the time when this myth started to gain traction, Reconstruction after the Civil War was in full force, and the Indian Wars were picking up steam and eventually came to an end. And what the Thanksgiving myth did is it invented a narrative of colonial American history that wiped it clean of colonial history's most defining features, which were Indian Wars and slavery. Instead, it told a story about religiously minded family groups braving the dangerous Atlantic in order to live lives of religious freedom and piety and prosperity. It also allowed white New Englanders to distance themselves from what contemporaries called the Indian and Black problems. The narrative relegated those features of American history to the South and West and held up this kind of romanticized Northeast as the model for all good things in the United States.
So you put me in mind as you were talking of when I think I was in second grade, and I actually had lived among Indians when I was very young, when I was 4 years old. Well, earlier than that, I lived in Mexico, and then my parents and I traveled through the Southwest, and we stayed in an Indian pueblo, the Acoma Pueblo. So fast forward to second, I knew Indians as being serious, not smiling, fat, and happy, but serious and somewhat oppressed, certainly, and regarding whites with suspicion. So in second grade, we were told to draw pictures of Indians, and I drew one as I had experienced them, not a fat, happy, smiling Indian, as my teacher said, as she brandished my drawing in front of the class, saying that this was completely unacceptable, that Indians were fat, smiling and happy. And she put up everybody else's drawing, and mine she threw in the wastebasket. So this kind of myth is really something that needed to be enforced in some way. You know, the first pushback that you really talk about in the book is from a man named Frank James. Tell us who he was and what did he do?
Sure. So Frank James was an Aquinna Wampanoag, born in the Aquinna community on the island of Martha's Vineyard. He's a formally educated man. So, yeah, he lives his life in the 20th century and well-educated. He had a love of trumpet. He went on to the prestigious New England Conservatory of Music and received his degree there. But when no national orchestra would hire him because of racial segregation, he went on to become a music teacher and eventually director of music in the Nauset Public Schools on the eastern stretch of Cape Cod. Frank James was also interested in history, and he did a great deal of research into the primary sources of Plymouth Colony and its relations with the Wampanoag people. And what he discovered was that the Thanksgiving myth propagated in schools like the ones in which he taught was just patently false. And the primary sources laid that bare. And so when the 350th anniversary of Plymouth's founding was coming around in 1970, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts asked Frank James to speak at a celebratory event. And he wrote up a speech, submitted it to officials for review, and they rejected it, calling it too inflammatory. It was inflammatory because he called the history straight. He laid it bare, warts and all, and that is not what the state wanted. So rather than participate in this kind of charade celebrating the demise of his people, Frank James organized his own commemoration where there would be no censors. And he called it the National Day of Mourning. And this was a protest event which gathered at the site of the Massasoit statue. Massasoit or Usumequin was the Wampanoag sachem or chief who made the alliance, a famous alliance with the Pilgrims of Plymouth. So he organized this protest at the Massasoit statue on a hill overlooking Plymouth Rock in Plymouth Town. And so at that event, speakers from various native tribes in New England and various representatives from the AIM movement, the American Indian Movement for Indigenous Rights and Justice, gathered. And it started a tradition, which is carried on to this very day, of holding this protest event every Thanksgiving. And what the event is designed to do is to allow Native people to express their version of colonial history. And their version of colonial history is far more bloody, it's far darker, and chronologically, it doesn't end in 1676 or 1776. For Indigenous people, colonial history extends to the present time because they still have to fight for their sovereignty, for their cultural autonomy, and for basic recognition. In other words, this National Day of Mourning has resonance to this very day.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Silverman about his book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. So now, give us a broad picture of Northeast America during this time. We'll focus on the Wampanoags, but first, tell us about Indian country. You know, in the years before the Pilgrims came there, just give us a sense of what Indian life and culture was like.
Sure. I think it's important to approach this subject with a set of conceptual tools that might not occur to your listeners. I think the first thing we need to do in order to understand Native America on the eve of contact with colonists is to dispense with these ideological blinders that America was a new world, that Native people only had prehistory before the English arrived, and that America was a wilderness. None of those concepts help us to see the rich, dynamic, and ancient history of Native America for what it was. Native America was not a new world. It might have been for Europeans, but the place was ancient. Indigenous people had been in the Americas for many thousands of years. And they weren't frozen in some kind of Stone Age existence until Europeans came and brought real history to them. They had experienced dramatic developments over the course of those centuries. They include not least of all the rise of corn, bean, squash horticulture, which began to develop in southern New England, where the Wampanoags lived a few hundred years before the Mayflower's arrival. And, you know, as a result of these thousands of years of history, the Northeast was a crowded place, you know, full of hundreds of thousands of indigenous people divided into different tribal groups, and within those tribal groups into different communities with various degrees of autonomy. Just in southern New England alone, one encountered different tribes like the Wampanoags. To their west were the Narragansetts, and farther west still were the Pequots and the Mohicans. To the north were the Massachusetts people, and to the north and west were the Nipmucks, the Pecumtucks, and the Sakokis. In other words, this was a crowded, politically divided place. As for the Wampanoags, they were a confederacy of dozens of communities. Those individual communities were called sachemships. The individual communities were led by leaders called sachems, and they tended to defer to the authority of what one might call a paramount sachem or a great sachem, which in the case of the Wampanoags, on the eve of contact with the Mayflower, that sachem was Usamequin, otherwise known by his title Massasoit.
So this was where they were when the first encounters with Europeans came. It wasn't just the English, there were the French as well. And of course, in other places, there were the Spanish. These early encounters you show in the book nearly always ended in violence. As an example of that, talk about not just the violence, but also the enslavement that went on, the capture of people. And tell us about Ipanau and Tisquantum, because they are very important figures in this book.
Sure. I think it will also come as a surprise to your listeners to discover that the arrival of the Mayflower off of Cape Cod was not a first contact episode. Not at all. The Wampanoags and other Native people in New England had a century of experience with Europeans before the arrival of the Pilgrims in 1620. The first documented contact between the Wampanoags and Europeans was in 1524, and that was with a French-employed Italian explorer named Giovanni de Verrazzano, whose name, I must note, is misspelled on the bridge leading between New Jersey and Staten Island. Those contacts began to pick up rather dramatically after the year 1602. They were rather intermittent between 1524 and 1602. Between 1602 and 1620, they occurred regularly. During the summer, Native people along the coast could expect to come into contact with 3, 4 or more European vessels during that season. European vessels were there for a variety of reasons. Sometimes these contacts were an extension of European fishing in the Gulf of Maine. Very often, lay people are unaware of just how active Europeans were in the fisheries of the North Atlantic coast, starting with Newfoundland and then extending down the coast of Maine. And, you know, sometimes at the tail end of their missions, they would ventured down the coast to try to trade with indigenous people for furs. Other Europeans were there to explore. They were interested in what profits they could wrest from colonial or trading ventures in the Americas. And at other times, they were there to seize human beings in order to transport them back across the Atlantic and sell them into slavery. I think most of the American public is unaware of how common it was for Europeans to enslave Native Americans during the 16th century, during the 17th century, and into the 18th century. Overall, the numbers that we're looking at during the course of the colonial period is somewhere between 3 to 5 million indigenous people enslaved by Europeans hemispherically. During the 1600s, one was just as likely to encounter Native American slaves as African slaves in the colonies. That would change dramatically in the 18th century, where African enslavement became the norm. But Europeans had very little compunction about seizing and enslaving indigenous people during this period. And that activity did indeed characterize the Wampanoag's contacts with Europeans in the decades before the arrival of the Mayflower. Now, most of the stories of the people who suffered these ordeals are lost to history. We know they were captured, we know they were sold, and then we have no documentation about them. But what's quite striking and consequential for the history of the Wampanoags in Plymouth is that two Wampanoags taken to Europe as captives actually made it back. One of them is barely known to anyone but historians. His name is Ipanau. He was from the island of Martha's Vineyard. And he was taken captive and transferred to a man named Sir Ferdinando Gorges, who was an organizer of colonial ventures. And he collected Indians to train them as interpreters and guides for his future ventures. Ipanau became wise to English people's values fairly quickly. And once he gained some command of the English language, he promised to lead Sir Ferdinando Gorges and his men to the gold reserves of Martha's Vineyard. And I don't know if any of your listeners have ever been to Martha's Vineyard, but I can assure you there is no gold there. This was Ipanau's ticket home. And sure enough, Gorges outfitted a mission to bring Ipanau back to the vineyard. And no sooner had they anchored off the shore than Ipanau jumped overboard while his tribesmen pinned down the crew with arrows, and he swam away to safety. 4 years later, in 1619, this is 6 months before the arrival of the Mayflower, Ipanau managed to connive another English explorer named Captain Dermer to come to Martha's Vineyard on the pretense of trading with him. And when Dermer and his crew landed, Ipanau led a massacre of them. Dermer managed to make it back to the ship with fatal wounds, and that's why we know of the story. Suffice it to say, when Plymouth Colony was founded, Ipanau was one of its many enemies by virtue of his experience of treachery at English hands. More familiar to your listeners, doubtless, is another one of these captives who made it back, and that's Tisquantum, better known as Squanto. He would go on to become the interpreter and intermediary between the Wampanoag sachem, Massasoit or Usamequin, and the English of Plymouth. In Squanto's case, he was captured by an English captain named Thomas Hunt and transported to Spain for sale into slavery. Some Spanish friars freed him before he became lost to history. And then through a number of occurrences that are very poorly documented, he fell into the possession of English merchants who worked in the city of Malaga in Spain. And those merchants in turn transferred him to another colonial organizer who was the treasurer of the Newfoundland Company in London, a guy named John Slaney. And Slaney saw an opportunity, much as Gorges had with Ipanau, to train Tisquantum as an interpreter and guide. And for a couple of years, Tisquantum lived in London. He visited Newfoundland twice. He very well might have met Pocahontas during her visit to London in 1616. And then finally, In 1619, Slaney decided to send Tisquantum home. By the way, he did so in the ship captained by none other than the fateful Thomas Dermer, who Epinal would later kill on this mission. And then Tisquantum makes it back. And to his dismay, the world that he enters was not the world that he had left. In his absence, a terrible epidemic disease had struck the Wampanoags and wiped out his home community of Patuxent on the very site where the English would later found Plymouth Colony. The big point here is that when the English arrive, the Wampanoags not only have a century of experience with Europeans coming to their own homeland and behaving like brutes, but at least two of them had been to Europe. They had traveled much of the Atlantic world and knew who these people were, knew what resources they drew upon, knew what values drove them. And so, contrary to the Thanksgiving myth, these people were not naive. They were not awestruck. They were not timid. They engaged with the English from a position of knowledge.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with historian David Silverman about his book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Now let's talk about that epidemic, because I was really struck. I mean, of course, most of us know the outlines of that epidemics that struck Native Americans in North and South America, killed perhaps 90% of the population. And that was certainly true here. But first of all, what possibly was it, was the epidemic? And why is there nearly no record from the Indians themselves? You say that that speaks volumes. And then tell us what the impacts were.
Yeah, so first, some general context about discussing the issue of disease. You know, it's in recent decades that we as historians and we as the public have become aware that the introduction of epidemics from Europe, Asia, and Africa to the Americas should rank as one of the most significant disasters in modern world history. As you note, these diseases wiped out sizable numbers of indigenous people. In some cases, the losses were dramatic, running as high as 90%. In other cases, you know, the losses were less dramatic, but dramatic still, right? And so these diseases played a critical role in depopulating much of the hemisphere. But I am very reluctant and I'm wary of to attribute too much importance to these diseases. And it's for this reason. Too often, the public line is, well, those diseases were an unfortunate accident of history, but no one was at fault. And therefore, European dominance of the continent was inevitable. Well, it's true that by and large, these diseases were no one's fault, but they did not make European dominance of the continent inevitable. Native people still survived in sizable numbers, and given the opportunity to recover from these diseases, they most certainly would have done so. What happened was that Europeans and their successors took advantage of native depopulation. And in many cases, the very work of colonialism made native people more susceptible to these diseases because of malnutrition or crowding together in fortified settlements, psychological stress, and the like. And so I want to caution your readers against allowing the story of epidemic disease to take colonists and their successors off the hook for their activities. So with that, as you know, this disease that devastated the Wampanoags and many of their neighbors to the north struck them between 1616 and 1619. So these are the years before the Mayflower's arrival in 1620. As for the identity of the disease, we just don't know. Contemporaries called it a plague, but that term was used for terrible diseases in general. No one identified it as the plague, by which I mean the bubonic plague that many of us know devastated Europe centuries earlier. So we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is that when the pilgrims arrived, and they were very interested in the story of this disease, they could see the remains of human beings rotting all over the landscape. Indeed, they called the area in which they settled Golgotha, after the hill where the Romans crucified Jesus back in biblical times. And they were interested in this disease because they saw it as evidence of God's providence, of God's omnipotence. They explained this disease in spiritual terms, and for that matter, the Wampanoags did too, albeit in different manner. So, they asked the Wampanoags repeatedly about what had happened. And it's striking to me that the Wampanoags had a pattern of making their opinions clear, even in a historical record controlled by the English. And I can sense that they were very reluctant to talk about this event. And I suspect this has to do with the trauma that they had experienced. We know that some communities, like Squanto's community of Patuxet, lost nearly everyone. Other communities probably lost half or more. And I ask my readers, imagine yourself at an extended family reunion with your aunts and your uncles, your cousins, second cousins, and right on down the line, because effectively that's what a Wampanoag village was. And now imagine that the majority of those people die in a matter of days from a disease no one has ever seen before and that no one can explain. Of course, these people were utterly traumatized by the experience. And perhaps it is for that reason that they didn't want to talk about it again. I believe they wanted to bury the memory of this horrific event. But they couldn't escape its fallout. The fact of the matter was that though the Wampanoags had been devastated by the disease, their rivals to the west, the Narragansett tribe, had not contracted it, which probably tells you that there wasn't an awful lot of contact between the Wampanoags and the Narragansetts. And after the disease had ebbed, the Narragansetts began taking advantage of their population advantage to subject the Wampanoags to tributary status. It's for that reason, above all, that Usamequin, the Wampanoag leader, decided ultimately to reach out to the English of Plymouth, despite his people's long history of violence with English explorers and slavers. He was desperate to alter the intertribal balance of power.
David Silverman. We'll talk more with him about the real story behind Thanksgiving after the break. Let's listen to a song from Marge Bruschak, who we'll also be talking with later on in the show. In addition to being an ethnohistorian and Native American storyteller, she performs Algonquian music and oral traditions. Let's hear a song from her album Voices in the Woods, Abenaki Indian Songs and Stories. The song is called Mothers.
A mother brought us into this earth, brought us into this earth. A mother gave us life and birth, gave us life and birth. A mother. Teach us what they know, what they know. The mothers will watch us grow. All the four-legged ones will watch us grow. All the water-bound ones will watch us grow. Just grow. All the mothers will watch. just grow.
Marge Bruschak singing Mothers on her album Voices in the Woods. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with historian David Silverman about his book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Just before the break, Silverman was telling us about how the Wampanoag chief Usamequan, also known by his title Massasoit, reached out to the Plymouth colonists to make a treaty. Let's pick up the thread where we left off. And so this is the context within which the so-called First Thanksgiving happened. You see, he reached out. They made a kind of agreement between them. You know, there were differing interpretations of the agreement between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoags, Usamequin. What are some of the key differences in how they saw, informed by their cultural differences as well, that characterized the way they approached that agreement?
So the English saw the agreement as a pact between heads of state, between their governor and Usamequin, chief of the Wampanoags. And they expected that lines of communication would run between those two heads of state or their delegates. The English hoped that this treaty would eventually lead to the Wampanoags falling under English authority, becoming subjects of the King of England, and by extension, subjects of the king's proxies, the English at Plymouth. They saw the treaty as a mutual defense pact. They included a provision in which they expressed their expectation that if any Wampanoags committed crimes against the English, Usamequin would turn them over to English justice. And more generally, it was an agreement for the two peoples to trade together. The Wampanoags, for the most part, did not see this agreement in those terms. Yes, Usamequin did see the alliance as a mutual defense pact. That on that they could agree. His expectation was that the trade would include English firearms and other weapons in order to defend his people against the Narragansetts. The English of Plymouth were not too keen to exchange such items to native people surrounding them. Usamequin certainly had no intention of ever turning over his people to English justice. After all, the English were guests in his country, not he in theirs. And the evidence of his understanding there, it can be plainly seen in the fact that the Wampanoags never, ever turned over their people to English judgment. That would have been inconceivable to them. But I think at a more fundamental level, Usamequin didn't see this alliance as simply an agreement between heads of state. It was a friendship in which the Wampanoags expected to receive hospitality and welcome in English communities whenever they showed up. And by when I say Wampanoags, I don't mean just Usamequin and his ambassadors. I mean everybody. And likewise, they expected that they would reciprocate if the English visited their communities. It meant that the two peoples could travel in their shared environment without fear of assault from the other. It was the expectation that the English would abide by Wampanoag rules and that they would defer to the leadership of Wampanoag sachems. In other words, the expectation was that the English were there to benefit the Wampanoag people. That was the only reason that the Wampanoags allowed the English to settle there in the first place.
Well, it didn't quite work out that way.
No, it did not.
But let's move on now. We're playing with during Thanksgiving week, so let's move on to that first so-called Thanksgiving. So there are some myths. I mean, we talked about the myth of Thanksgiving in the beginning, but there are even, you know, some myths specifically about, say, the meal. So give us a picture there. What happened and how is it different from our image of it? And what was the import of it?
So this first Thanksgiving, if you will, it wasn't a Thanksgiving as the English understood that Thanksgivings to be. In the English tradition, days of Thanksgiving were days of fasting, not feasting. And one would spend those days of fasting in church, bestowing thanks upon God or seeking mercies for God during times of trouble. And, these events would end with a feast to break the fast. That's not what this event was. This event was a harvest feast after Plymouth Colony's first successful harvest. And there was good reason to celebrate. Plymouth had lost half its numbers during the terrible first winter. The people, when they first arrived, were vulnerable and knew they needed Indian protectors if they were going to survive in this place. And by the fall of that year, they had brought in a successful harvest. They could feed themselves. They had Wampanoag protectors. The Wampanoags had also showed them how to harvest wild foods like fish and shellfish, and had taught them how to plant corn, beans, and squash in the native manner. And so, the English had good reason to breathe a sigh of relief and celebrate a little. The famous feast occurs when 90 Wampanoags led by Usamequid show up at Plymouth Colony. Wampanoag tradition is that they heard the English firing guns in celebration, as it turned out, but the Wampanoags believed that the English were under attack, perhaps from the Narragansetts, perhaps from the French, and rushed to their defense. In any other time and place in colonial America, 90 native men armed showing up at a colonial settlement would have resulted in a bloodbath. But because of the diplomacy that had taken place over the previous 6 months, everyone showed some reserve. And instead of a bloodbath, the English invited the Wampanoags to stay and feast with them. And that's what they did for the next few days. They're feasting mostly on wild foods, venison, eels, lobster, some of the crops that the English had cultivated. Most of the foods that we associate with Thanksgiving would not have been there. There might have been turkey. We don't know. The English only mentioned fowl, which could have meant just ducks and geese. It's hard to say. No pies. The English did not have refined sugar or flour to cook with. There wouldn't even have been cranberry sauce, even though there were wild cranberries available locally, because one normally wouldn't eat them without sugar. So it's not the kind of affair that we normally associate with Thanksgiving. This event also has an outsized importance in our public memory as a component of the Wampanoag English Alliance. In fact, it really was an unimportant event in the scheme of things. There were a number of other rather less palatable episodes filled with power politics and more than a little violence that shaped this alliance. The English hardly wrote about it at all. All we have is a paragraph of four lines about this event, and neither the English nor the Wampanoags invoked it in future diplomacy. So Thanksgiving has such prominence in public memory as a result of American myth-making, not because of the importance ascribed to it by historical actors on the ground.
After reading this book, Thanksgiving is one of the main festivals I do look forward to. But after reading this book, I feel a little guilty now. I'm not sure whether we should celebrate it. And I would just want to ask you, you were not Wampanoag, but I wonder, do you celebrate Thanksgiving? And if so, what are your thoughts around doing that? Or what is your recommendation for our listeners and how they should approach it?
Well, I can tell you what I think, and I can tell you what I've heard Wampanoag people tell me, which I think might be the more important point. One of the things your readers will learn from this book is that Thanksgiving was not associated with the Pilgrim Wampanoag story for hundreds of years. That's a fairly recent invention. I love Thanksgiving. This is not a book railing against the celebration of Thanksgiving. I like to gorge myself on pie as much as the next guy. And I like to get together with family and friends and reflect on the goodness of our lives. But there's no reason we have to attach that ritual to this false history, a history that I think is actually rather damaging. So what I would prefer is to see us disassociate Thanksgiving from the Pilgrim Indian myth. or if we're going to continue to associate it with the Pilgrim Indian story, let's get it straight. Let's get this history right and use it as an opportunity to reflect on the troubled history of colonialism and the fraught place of Indigenous people in American life, rather than sanitizing it, rather than trafficking in a bedtime story that makes light of Indigenous people's traumas and that indoctrinates our children in a way that makes them less capable of being critical of the United States and its origins. Wampanoag people have a variety of opinions on Thanksgiving. A great many of them do celebrate Thanksgiving. They, like everyone else, like to get together with family and friends and take a moment to reflect. But they don't associate the holiday with an uplifting colonial story. Some Wampanoag people, consistent with Frank James's National Day of Mourning protest, use the occasion to mourn, to reflect on the people and the places that they've lost. And I think that that's an exercise that we should all be cognizant of and perhaps even model.
Well, this has just been a fascinating conversation. David Silverman, your really important book is This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Thank you so much for telling us the true story behind this holiday.
I'm appreciative of your interest. Thank you.
David Silverman teaches Native American, Colonial American, and American racial history at George Washington University. In addition to This Land is Their Land, he's the author of two previous books about Native America and colonial history. Next up, we hear from Native American storyteller and ethnohistorian Marge Bruchak. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our theme today is the myth and reality of Thanksgiving. Earlier, we heard from historian David Silverman. Our annual replaying of my interview with Native American ethnohistorian Marge Bruchak adds detail to the story. And she retells a myth told by her own tribe, the Abenaki, about how corn came to the people. When Thanksgiving rolls around, Native American storyteller and historian Marge Bruchak gets a lot of requests to talk about the first Thanksgiving, when the English settlers got together with the Wampanoag natives of Massachusetts for a feast. The year was 1621. Bruchak co-authored the book, 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. We continue our annual tradition of airing Bruchak's true story of Thanksgiving.
The entire myth of this event as the so-called First Thanksgiving, as this foundational moment in American history, is based on Edward Winslow's account of a 1621 autumn harvest feast, when he writes, "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn, and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas, and according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance, and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good, but our peas not worth the gathering." And he goes on to note that that was the first successful harvest they had had, and being that it was a good harvest, it was time to gather together and celebrate the harvest.
So why did they choose to invite the Indians, or did they choose
well, they
to invite
didn't.
The Indians?
That's the important. That's a very important detail people often miss. They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who remember had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers. So when Massasoit showed up with 90 men to investigate what's going on, you can tell from the records that he was suspicious. It's only after he arrives and realizes that it's a feast they're preparing for that he sends his men out and they hunt four deer and bring them back. And so the largest quantity of food is not even this harvest that the colonists have brought in using native technology, using native styles of fertilizing and everything else to prepare the food. That's not the bulk of the food. The bulk of the food is the deer and the corn and the native food that Massasoit and his people bring.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've shown us how the myth differs from the reality. Well, you've shown us how the reality differs from the myth. And yet that myth is there. It's a very powerful one. What do you think that's about? If you have you done any thinking about why was this myth necessary? Why was it necessary for white Americans to create a myth of friendship with the peoples that they had conquered?
The important point to make is not there was friendship. There was a negotiated friendship. The myth implies that Native people had already vanished by that moment in time, and that the few Indians who were left were invited to a feast that the English hosted. So I think the nature of the myth gives the English a sense of dominance over the landscape and over the history at a moment in time when they were in fact struggling and starving and about to disappear themselves.
There's something about that one big happy family.
Right, that's the mythical part, that one big happy multicultural family, that forgets the fact that this is Native landscape. It forgets the fact that the Plymouth colony is very, very small. And the entire continent of North America, the entire continent of South America, is all Indian country. Even though there have been plagues, even though there has been contact, it's all Indian country. And so what often happens is that tiny little Plymouth colony, hanging on for dear life on the coast, is made to look much larger than it is in fact, and is given so much more power than it has at that moment in time. And that power just extends across the continent with manifest destiny. And I think that's the danger of the myth. If it were a truer rendition of the story, you would start from the Wampanoag perspective of a long inhabited landscape, more than 12,000 years, and considering how you deal with this small band of strangers who enter into your landscape. And you would learn from the Wampanoag point of view that negotiation, reaching out, helping strangers is part of their way. And even little details like the first person to encounter the colonists is not Massasoit, it's Samoset, who is an Abenaki sachem. He's from north in what's now Maine, and he's traveled down to this territory, and he sees these people, and he knows who these people are. They've been taking captives from the coast for several decades now. There are more than 80 Native people stolen from Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Wampanoag territory, all up and down the coast, have already been taken back to England as captives. None of these Native people are in awe at the arrival of the pilgrims, but they make a decision, and the decision they make on the spot is a negotiated peace. And I think that's what's lost in that myth of the happy family.
One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Bruchak is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers, and she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words, she listens to the story, she watches how the old care for the young, and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together, and she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She is grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister, and she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, "Oh no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you." And she says, "No, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place and my gift will come to you." And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields. and they pile the earth over it, and they watch, and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there is the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, Vemkita, Kikta, Olioni, to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes.
Marge Bruschak is an anthropologist, historian, and museum consultant. In addition to 1621, she's the author of other books, including the children's book Malian Song. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle, and co-founder of the Children and Nature Network. He's got a great new book out, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Well, that's it this week on Writer's Voice. Please make sure to like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. It really helps to spread the word about the show. Happy Thanksgiving!